BBC World Service. This is Helena Merriman with The Inquiry. This week, what will happen when robots take our jobs? At an American hospital in Ohio, an anaesthetist is about to sedate a patient. It's one of the most delicate arts of medicine, involving years of training. Get it wrong, and the patient could feel great pain or even die. But this anaesthetist is not suffering from pre-op nerves. That's because it's a machine. Four hospitals in the US are now using machines instead of anaesthetists to sedate patients for simple procedures. It costs around $200, a fraction of what a human could be paid. Good news for hospital administrators, bad news for the highly trained anaesthetist. In fact, it's bad news for anyone who thought that robots only threatened blue-collar, routine-based jobs. Machines have now written news stories, performed legal discovery work, diagnosed lung cancer, landed planes, traded on Wall Street, composed music, and performed mini biopsies. A report from two leading economists found that in the next 20 years, almost half of the jobs in the US are at risk of being automated. It's clear. Robots are already taking some of our jobs, and more are under threat. What's less clear is what happens next. And that's what this week's inquiry is all about. What will happen when robots take our jobs?
Part 1. We'll just create new ones.
Everybody has to adapt.
Meet the versatile Pippa Malmgren. She was once President George Bush's
advisor on economic affairs in the White House.
And she now runs
a company here in London that advises fund managers and investors around the world.
Oh, and she also founded a robotics company that makes drones. Drones that are doing what a human used to do.
These are for things like surveying buildings and bridges and agricultural farmland. So yes, drones are going to displace these methods, and that does mean people's jobs are going to be affected.
She's not apologetic about putting people out of work. Instead, she says we should all do what she's done throughout her career. Adapt.
So I really have trouble with this idea of mass unemployment. We've been afraid of that for generations. And every single time we create new businesses, new activities that no one 10 years before, let alone 100 years before, could possibly have imagined. I mean, even today we have, you know, a community of people who make apps. Nobody even knew what that meant 10 years ago.
But it's not very labor intensive. I mean, you look at these tech companies, yeah. They don't employ that many people.
I agree. But that doesn't mean that employment can only occur in these areas. It
Such
actually
as...
puts a premium on things like, if we're going to talk about sewing, haute couture that's done by hand.
So we'll start to value things simply because they're not automated.
I think that's already happening.
And some of us may come to value humans more, she says, simply for not being robots.
I would bet that for every person who says, I'd rather have a robot look after me in my old age, you will also find someone who says, there is not a chance in hell that I want a robot looking after me. I want a person that I'm going to have a conversation with.
So when robots take our jobs, we'll just create new ones, she says. Jobs that satisfy our desires for non-automated products and experiences. So no need for mass panic. As long as we all ask ourselves one simple question.
Is the work I do right now at risk? And for some of us, the answer is going to be, yeah. Okay, instead of saying, oh, no, you know, I won't have an income and I won't be able to have the life I want, you say, no, okay, I have to change. I have to go learn something different.
And who are those people? Who are most at risk right now?
Everyone.
Am I at risk?
I think you're at risk because we're already seeing computers that are writing news stories, right? So frankly, you're going to have to ask yourself, what do I bring to the table that a computer can't do?
Not the answer I was hoping for. And the list of things I can do that a computer can't? Worryingly short. It's a strange new world. We're all used to comparing ourselves to high achievers we work with, but comparing ourselves to machines, that's new. And something we'll have to get used to if we want to carry on working. Welcome to the era of CV brush-ups and online courses.
People are very frightened about these tools replacing human beings, but they should be no more frightened about it today than they should have been about the printing press. I mean, we've been having these kinds of technology innovations since forever.
She's got a point. This isn't the first time we've gone through a technological revolution. Depending on your view of history, it's the second, or even the third. So what's happened in the past when machines have taken our jobs?
Part 2. A painful adjustment.
My name is Joel Mokyr. I'm a professor of economics and history at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois.
Joel loves what he does. It's why he works 14-hour days. A workaholic, then?
My wife claims that steadfastly. I deny it.
And during those long days, poring over books, one period in history has drawn him back again and again. He describes it as
the most important single change in economic history ever to happen.
He's now written
six
books about it. With the arrival of the spinning mule, the power loom and the cotton gin, the Industrial Revolution changed the way we lived forever.
Before the Industrial Revolution, the vast majority of people lived very precarious lives, had life expectancies in the sort of low or mid-30s, very high infant mortality. And what happens in the middle of the 18th century is the beginning of a process that eventually has liberated, I would say, most, if not all, members of the human race from that kind of life.
Before that liberation, though, there was pain.
The first two generations of the Industrial Revolution saw very little of the benefits. Mechanization and technological progress gradually removed certain jobs from the economy or made them eventually untenable.
Take handloom weavers, young men who would work on wooden looms in their attics or a shed outside the house. But then
the mechanization of weaving becomes a reality, and then in the next two or three decades, handloom weavers basically vanish from the scene.
And what do we know about those people who lost their jobs? What was life like for them?
Dramatic and traumatic. These people were struggling at ever lower incomes. Many of them sent their children to work in the factories because that was one way of making an income. But for that sort of transitional generation, this was a difficult period.
In 1842, an Irish writer described coming across a weaver begging on the side of the road. He was the living skeleton of a giant, he wrote. Before Christmas, everything had disappeared, including his clothes, his wife and children. When I offered him a shilling, he refused it until I'd given him my name and address that he might repay it.
I'll sing the achievements of General Lodd, now the hero of Nottinghamshire.
Some decided that a life of begging was not for them. Instead, they rose up.
The most famous resistance, of course, was the so-called Luddite rebellion in the Midlands between 1811 and 1816.
Those engines of mischief were sentenced to die by unanimous vote of the trade. And Ludd, who can all opposition defy, was the grand executioner made.
Named after the mythical hero Ned Ludd, the English Luddites smashed industrial machines like the automated loom and the cropping frame that put skilled workers out of a job. The government's response?
The leaders were executed and many other peoples were transported to Australia. And so the British government landed on these rebellions with a very heavy-handed policy, and they took no prisoners.
Those riots had as much impact as a snowflake hitting a tank. They couldn't slow the advance of the steam engines and factories. But just across the English Channel, it was a different story. In the 1790s, during the Revolutionary Wars, the French Republic introduced a new technology for making muskets.
And this was fiercely resisted by the French armourers, the people who made muskets. And in fact, the whole project was eventually shelved simply because at time of war, the French government could not afford all of its armourers to go on strike.
So the development of gun manufacturing moved to the US. And that wasn't the only industry affected by protests. The introduction of the sewing machine was delayed by decades.
Because of the resistance of milliners who threatened to burn down the house of the inventor. And so in France and in other parts of Europe, there is much more successful resistance than in England.
From the rearview mirror, technological revolutions can seem inevitable. But the defiance in France is a reminder that resistance can be disruptive, delaying the introduction of technology. And the riots in Britain, while ineffective, mark the suffering of those who lost work. So what will happen when the robots take our jobs? In the short term, it's likely there'll be pain and perhaps resistance. So what can we do now to prepare for it?
Part 3. Pay and conditions.
Well, I played chess as a kid.
Meet our third expert witness.
And when I was a kid, I'm 53 now, chess playing computers were not very good. I was able to beat them.
When was the last time you beat a computer at chess?
Oh, in modern times, I've never beat a computer at chess, and I never will. It wouldn't matter how many times I tried. Way back when, we said, oh, chess, that's so intuitive. Computers will never master it. Well, basically, they have. So we need to think about what's coming next.
And that's exactly what Tyler Cowan, professor of economics at George Mason University, has been doing. When he's not updating his ethnic food guide to Washington, D.C., or running the university think tank, or posting on his popular economics blog, he's been thinking about the future and how automated jobs might change the way we live. In his latest book, Average is Over, he argues that, well, average is over. We can say goodbye to a steady, middle-of-the-road kind of life.
I think we're going to see a much larger group of people really earning a lot. So what we now call the top 1% will over time become the top 10, top 15%.
And that top 15% will be made up of those who are good at maths, with analytical brains who can work alongside machines. And the rest of us?
We'll probably end up in service sector jobs, often lower-end service sector jobs. But of course, as you crowd more people into those sectors, the wages fall or they're stagnant. And in both my country and yours, over the last 10 to 12 years, wages for a lot of service sector workers really have not gone up for the lower skilled part of the distribution.
He doesn't think we'll all be out of a job. Instead, our pay will flatline. So what do you think the political effects of this could be?
Well, I think our futures will be largely peaceful.
Peaceful? No Luddite-style revolts?
Both the United States and the United Kingdom were becoming older countries. Older people are less likely to revolt and rebel. So I think we will walk into this future, not really debate it very much, and for better or worse, simply make do.
So you don't think people will be out on the streets protesting as they see more and more jobs disappearing?
Think about the most radical time period in our past, the 1960s. That was a great decade for the middle class. It's actually high and rising wages which tend to raise expectations, which lead to social trouble. This is a little counterintuitive, but if anything, I think we're likely to see more disengagement.
It's worth pausing here. His point is that as wages stagnate, we'll lower our expectations and come to accept this new way of living.
Occupy Wall Street didn't really go anywhere, did it? So people, I would say, have already learned to accept it. You know, social media, you could say it's the new opiate of the masses. A lot of people with flat incomes, they'll actually have these increases in living standards due to the internet. They'll have more fun, they'll have better social connections. Maybe they'll, you know, have more sex or better romance or easier access to drugs.
It's an unsettling vision. We'll slip into a social media-induced coma and disengage politically. And not only will individual countries change radically, so too will the relationships between them.
The big impact will be on the emerging economies. So take a country like South Korea or earlier Japan and Taiwan. Those countries competed by having low wages and doing a lot of manufacturing and exporting. But the more that factory work is done by robots and software, the less of an advantage low wages will be. So that East Asian path toward being fully developed, arguably that's gone away and probably it's never really coming back.
He's talking about the disruption of traditional economic models we've relied on for decades. Countries that were on an upwards path may well find that well-trodden route not only blocked, but it may disappear altogether. So can governments cushion the blow, ease us into this new automated future? Yes, says Tyler Cowan. They can start by
making lives more affordable by lowering costs and expenses. We need to radically change our education system so that it keeps up with technology. No country really has that right now. The core areas of education, healthcare, and living costs, that's really where we could make big improvements.
So what will happen when the robots take our jobs? So far, we've heard that if we adapt, we'll create new ones, but that it's likely to be a traumatic experience, much like the Industrial Revolution. And as more jobs become automated, there'll be profound shifts in our societies. But here's a question for you. What if the pace of change is so fast that many of us can't adapt?
Part 4. A world without work.
Personally, I don't think there will be an area of work that we know of at the moment that a robot won't be able to do.
Meet David Baker, an energetic journalist who writes about the way technology affects our lives. He has a second job too, probably just as well from what we've heard in this programme. We'll hear more about that in a moment.
You know, creativity, dexterity, compassion, these were things that will work out ways for computers to do. These are not philosophical problems, they're actually engineering problems.
If he's right, and one day those engineering problems are solved, and robots are able to do pretty much everything we do, what then?
Personally, I think we should welcome them. I think work has become too much like drudgery. Most people are bored quite a lot of time. It's a kind of social control.
How would you feel if you were told, well, we've got some great robot journalists now. David, we just don't think we need you anymore.
You see, I quite like the robot journalism. I think it's pretty good stuff. All the way through my career, as many of us, I've had moments where something has replaced what I offer the workplace. And I think that actually the core skill we need to develop as workers is adaptability.
Given that you said that you don't think there are any fields of work that a computer can't one day do, what if at some point there's nothing you can adapt to?
OK. If we get to a point where automation can do all our jobs and there's nothing we can adapt to, we're going to have to say, OK, well, I live in a world without work.
A world without work. There are so many questions that raises, it's hard to know where to begin. Perhaps with this one. Where would we get money to buy stuff?
We might have something like a citizen's wage, which pays us for, if you like, doing nothing. And then we could go and do some work which is more true to our talents, rather than having to work in a certain way simply to go and buy food at the supermarket.
OK. Let's say the not insignificant political and economic hurdles could be overcome, and a citizen's wage, or what some call a basic income, introduced. Wouldn't some of us miss our jobs, the fulfilment and purpose they give us?
Almost everyone who's associated self-worth with work faces this problem when they retire. And we know that people, when they retire, go through huge periods of depression.
He knows this well, because in David's second job as a life coach, he helps people to find satisfaction outside of work.
And we try to help them find other activities which are non-money earning, which they can take a real interest and pride in. They could become beekeepers or potters or join a choir.
So while robots do the grunt work, we'll be collecting honey, making bowls or singing bark. It sounds tempting, but for some of us, it might not be so sweet when that's all we do, when the evening course becomes our life.
Maybe all we're just doing is moving the retirement age younger and saying, well, we might have to live half our life in this state where we have to understand that activities we choose to do are going to have to be chosen on the basis they feel purposeful rather than just because they earn money.
Are you confident that we can decouple those things, that we can decouple being paid for something and self-worth?
We, especially in the Protestant Anglo-Saxon world, have developed a philosophy which is that work that generates money is the most important activity in life, beyond probably even reproduction. But if the robots can free us from that link, then I think we've got a very exciting journey to start.
So instead of competing against us, robots could liberate us. But, he admits, things could go the other way.
There's going to be a big bunch of us who lose economically in terms of what our money can buy. And we are going to have to think about how we respond to that. I think we're in the adolescence of the digital age, and we have all these exciting ideas about the future of our lives, about half of which are completely wrong. We could have an amazing utopia caused by the advance of technology. Or we could have an amazing dystopia.
Sorry, it's not a very conclusive finish after 25 minutes. The truth is, no one really knows what will happen. It may be that enough jobs are created that we'll all have the option of working into old age. Or, with robots able to do our jobs more efficiently than us, we may have to get used to the idea of life without work. Either way, perhaps we're spending too much time worrying about what will happen in the long run, not enough on how to prepare in the short term.
We've learned we're not very good at dealing with a rapidly changing future. If work significantly diminishes in the wrong way, this will be a big loss for human societies, and I don't think we've quite thought this through enough.
It's not yet a central item on the agenda of the economics profession or politicians. And that is what you'd expect, you know, because usually we don't really discover that we're in a crisis until it's almost too late to do anything about it.
In other words, this is not a problem for future generations. Our politicians need to start addressing this right now, as do we. Asking ourselves, what can I bring to the table that a computer can't? What will my second, third, and fourth careers be? Without that kind of thinking, any one of us could end up like the handloom weaver, begging for a shilling on the side of the road. So what will happen when the robots take our jobs? Perhaps it's up to us.
This inquiry was presented by Helena Merriman and produced in London by Simon Mabin. It was mixed by Neil Churchill. The production coordinator is Janet Staples, and the editor is Richard Knight. If you like your questions more existential, you should check out our inquiry asking, should we fear artificial intelligence? It's on the website. And if you have a question you think we should be asking, demand an inquiry on the World Service Facebook page or on Twitter. We're at BBC The Inquiry.